Okay, I'm going to try again with the microphone. This is the second part then of the first week when I'm talking about women. I will come back to the conflict for the right to vote in a moment, but I wanted to make a little parenthesis about the first question I mentioned, the right for married women to have property. This was, of course, most important for women from the elites, and there were some rather surprising cases. For example, at this time it was possible to separate. If you were married, you could separate, but very difficult to divorce. Okay, so you could have separation but not divorce. The problem for women who were separated is that from the point of view of the law, everything they owned in fact belonged to their husband. Yeah.
What about widows?
Oh, widows were fine. Of course, they counted as unmarried. Yeah. Are you making a suggestion? okay. For example, there was one woman who was separated from her husband, and in order to make money, she wrote novels. She wrote literature. And she made some money, and her husband went to the tribunal and said, "That money is mine, because she's my wife." And the tribunal said, "Okay." So the situation in some extreme cases was really very grave indeed. And the campaign had some success in 1870. There was the first Married Women's Property Act. Married Women's Property Act, yeah, an act, c'est une loi, about married women's property. And in 1882, there was the second Married Women's Property Act. So after 1882, this problem was more or less solved. You were allowed to have property if you were a married woman. Now, before these laws, women from the elites had ways of keeping some of their property. For example, very typically, if you were a rich woman, just before you got married, you gave your big house to your brother. Yeah. So that if there was a problem in the marriage, they would not go to the husband. Yeah. So they had methods of adapting the situation if they were they were very rich. So that was successfully solved in 1882. The question of education was very, very slow, and I think I'll come back to that in a moment. The question of university education was very slow. But let's go back to the question of the right to vote. So, some women such as Emmeline Pankhurst, there she is, and today there is a statue of Emmeline Pankhurst in front of the Houses of Parliament. So that's a very privileged position, to be in front of the Houses of Parliament. Not many people are allowed to. Oliver Cromwell, Emmeline Pankhurst, well, she's on the side of the Houses of Parliament anyway. So obviously an important figure, and she launched, as I mentioned a few moments ago, a rival organisation in 1903, the Women's Social and Political Union, whose motto was "Deeds, not words." Des actions et plus de paroles. Des paroles, ça suffit. Il faut des actions. They had a new idea, and they decided to do direct action. Their objective was not to hurt people, but to damage property. And so it went in different stages. The first stage was breaking windows, like breaking all the windows in the government offices. There was a famous case where a suffragette went into the National Gallery, and she damaged a very famous painting, "Votes for Women," in the Le Venus de, a very famous and expensive painting. Anyway, so the idea was to damage property, also damaging golf courses, etc. So there was a whole stage when damaging property was the objective. Of course, this was tremendously shocking to people, also because many of the women were bourgeois women who were supposed to be respectable and nice and not like this. And so they were, of course, insulted in the media and so on. I know how they felt. This went on for a number of years. There's a very interesting interview with Christabel, with Emmeline Pankhurst, where somebody says to her, if you break windows and burn letterboxes and damage paintings, you will not convince people that you are right. And Emmeline Pankhurst said, my aim is not to convince people that we are right. My aim is to make political life impossible so they are obliged to give women the vote. So it's an interesting idea, yes, that she basically said the time for persuading people is finished, and now we just make life impossible in the country because we want it. Now, this was perhaps possible because it seems that after 1905, the majority of the population thought, oh, well, okay, yes, women should have the vote. Yeah. The campaign for public opinion had been successful. Unfortunately, as we have seen in some of these classes, public opinion does not make you win. It can be useful, but it's not enough to make you win. On dit toujours, tout le monde adore les infirmières, c'est surprenant qu'elles soient pas bien payées. Le fait qu'ils sont adorés, ça n'aide pas. Okay, so the public opinion is one element, but it's not necessarily the most important one. So they started their militant campaign in 1906. So here you have a couple of cartoons, again from people who are not so happy with the suffragettes. So, and here you have a suffragette, yes, obviously a bit crazy, with an axe cutting the policeman in half. This is not a true story. Okay, it's a caricature. The House of Commons, and there they are. What is she carrying? Is that a gun? Yeah. Oh no, it's a saw. She's quite an insane. I'm not quite sure. That seems to be a saw. Anyway, that's one. Again, Hazeldon, and on the other side, similarly. On the other side, you see what will happen if women get the votes, and you have a lot of pictures of men being badly treated by women. You know, the woman is the boss. Now, in the popular songs at the time, there were many popular songs against the suffragettes. A very famous one, which I'm not going to sing for you, but a very famous one is put me on an island where the girls are few, put me with the elephants in the zoo, something else, but for the love of God, keep me away from the suffragettes. And so the worst thing was the suffragette. There was also a famous song called The Ragtime Suffragettes. Yeah, the ragtime suffragette, she's no household pet. So mocking the suffragettes was a national sport. But it's interesting, at this time in 1910, for example, there are many songs which mock the suffragettes, the radical people. But there are not many songs. Okay, so yeah. There are not many songs which say women should not vote. Yeah. Women should not vote could not be a popular song in 1910 because the population was divided. Many people agreed. And pop music at the time was in the theatre. The singer was obliged to get everybody to sing. Everybody sing now. That was the method. And if half the people sing, you've lost your job because everybody must sing. And so it's interesting to see that the songs that everybody would sing were not against the right to vote for women, but they were suffragettes are ridiculous, suffragettes are stupid, etc. That is that the more militant ones are. Oh, more. Oh, that's the same, isn't it? No, it's more of the same. Yes, this gives a... I've broken windows. I smacked a policeman. I've knocked his hat off. I've used a whip. And they still won't give me the vote. Yes, so it's a... aren't they funny, the suffragettes? This is their idea. And there you have the meeting of the WSPU. Christabel Pankhurst, Jesse Kenny, Nellie Martel, Emmeline Pankhurst and Charlotte Despard. These are the leaders. The leaders. They didn't choose themselves the name suffragettes. The journalists chose this name suffragettes. And so when we're talking about this period, we usually say suffragist for those organisations which used traditional methods, petitions, demonstrations, meetings, etc. And suffragettes for the ones who wanted direct action against property. Breaking windows, burning letter pots, brûler les boîtes à lettres dans la rue. Remember, at this time, most people did not have phones. Most people did not have the internet. So the letters were extremely important for business. Everything happened by letter. And so when they went round London burning all the letters in every letterbox, this was a major problem for business. Yeah, because everything was written and sent, yeah. It was also very complicated to keep a copy. No photocopiers. So, of course, some businesses, they copied every letter twice and sent one. But, of course, small businesses didn't. So this was burning letterboxes was really quite a serious thing. C'est un petit peu comme si un groupe radical aujourd'hui réussissait à fermer l'internet dans la région parisienne pour une semaine. It would be really, for business, this would be a major problem, an enormous problem. Okay, that's... politic fiction. Now, they were arrested. There they are being arrested. And they shocked the world because people imagined at this time that this kind of activity was unnatural to women. And so it was especially shocking because it was unnatural. And once they were in prison, a lot of them were in prison. It's a few thousand women were imprisoned. A few thousand. Quelques milliers de femmes étaient emprisonnées. Et 36 hommes, je crois, quelque chose comme ça. Quand même. Okay. And when they were in prison, they decided to go on a hunger strike. That not the first year. This is a little later. They decide on the hunger strike, on grève de la faim, which is a very dangerous. Je ne le recommande pas si vous avez le choix. It's very, very dangerous, hunger strikes. And the government had a political problem. The government didn't want suffragettes to die in prison. It's not good for the image. And so they decided to introduce forced feeding. And in 1909, for the first time, they had forced feeding, donc l'alimentation forcée. This is not nice. This is about forced feeding of the nose or breaking the teeth, breaking teeth and force feeding like that. It's almost a form of torture. It's almost a form of torture. So this was obviously a situation where both sides were tremendously determined. And in a situation where probably the majority of public opinion was not against women's votes. Now, the majority of people were not necessarily... they didn't necessarily think it was very important, but they had no longer any objection. Next slide, please. So there you get... some of the pictures around forced feeding. These are two very different ones. If you look at this one, this is a poster of the suffragette saying, torturing women in prison, vote against the government. So when it came to election time, the suffragettes did a campaign, don't vote for the government because this is what they do to women. And this is a drawing, of course, not a photograph. This one is more shocking because this is a joke. This is humour, which is saying, "Oui, quand la femme c'est le chef, voilà le résultat." And it's supposed to be funny, Yeah, it's supposed to be funny, but very, very vicious anti-suffragette postcard in Kathpostan. Now, there were, at the same time as this, bigger and bigger demonstrations. And the suffragette leaders went around France and Germany and the United States to try to raise money and to explain. So, because direct action on its own was not enough, there was also a need for a lot of explanation, a lot of arguments. And some of Emmeline Pankhurst's speeches are really very impressive. So, when she was in America, she said, "You know that because you wanted democracy and the right to a voice, you went to war with Britain. Now we are at war with the British government for the right to vote for women." And they saw it as a war. However, they considered that tactically this was a war where guns were not the most useful method, but other methods were more appropriate. So enormous demonstrations in Hyde Park, enormous demonstrations in Glasgow, and this poster, which I took a photograph of in the People's Palace, I think it is, in Glasgow. This is a banner for the demonstrations. And can you see who the banner belongs to at the top? Yeah, the Northern Men's Federation for Women's Suffrage. So this is an organisation of men to support the women's suffrage. Of course, most of the organisations were women, but there were also men's organisations because this was a big issue now, and it was possible to mobilise people. And the slogan, "Now is the day and now is the hour." Another of the tactics they used in direct action was to cut the telegraph wires to stop telephones and telegrams. But in 1913, there was a particular event which made the front page of newspapers around the world. And that was Emily Davison, and she decided as a protest that when the important annual horse race, the Derby, was run — this is a very, very important horse race, everybody likes to watch the Derby — and one of the horses belonged to the king, and her objective was to stop the king's horse. So that she would be on the front page of every newspaper saying "Votes for Women." Yeah. And she was killed by the king's horse. Yeah, she was killed because it's dangerous to stop horses when they're racing. Yeah. And so she became something of a martyr. And this is the front page of their newspaper, The Suffragette. Remember the importance of newspapers. If a movement like this needs a newspaper every week to reply to what the other newspapers are saying — they're crazy, they're stupid, etc. Yeah, so the own newspaper, very important. And also the organisation of people selling the newspaper that structures the movement. Yeah, you can test people. They say, "Oh, you agree with us? Oh, yes, I agree with you. Do you want to read the paper? Oh, okay. Do you want to sell the paper?" Yeah, you've got a test there. You can test who is really serious. Yeah, "You want to sell the paper?" "Yes." "Ah, we have somebody serious." "You want to?" "Oh, well, maybe next week. I'm very busy with my garden." Yeah, newspapers are always a way of testing, because if you read the newspaper and you agree, okay. If you sell the newspaper, and then somebody comes back and says, "Oh, I don't agree with page 6. And you say, "Oh, page 6. Do I agree with page 6? I don't know." Yeah? It makes you have to think much more to sell a newspaper than to buy a newspaper. And so here you have Emily Wilson, so presented as an angel, who is, we imagine, as looking down on the movement from above. This is 1913. At this time, the government had a new idea, and that is that uh, uh, they they realized that force feeding was just too bad for the image. So they had a new idea. So if you were in prison on hunger strike, when the woman became weak after, I don't know, 10 days or 2 weeks of not eating, they released the woman, and when she got better, they arrested her again. Yeah. And this new law, which allowed the government to release prisoners if they were in bad health and then arrest them again 2 months later, had a popular name. It was called the Cat and Mouse Act. This is not the official name. Yeah, this is the popular name for it. So you can see it's a real political conflict, with the government thinking about tactics and the suffragettes thinking about tactics, everybody trying to see what's going on. And there you have then a poster by the suffragettes about the Cat and Mouse Act. That's this law which says we can release prisoners if they are very ill because they haven't been eating, and we will arrest them again when they feel better. So here you have the liberal cats, and there is in his mouth is a suffragette with the colours green and violet, which are the suffragette colours. The liberal cat: electors vote against him, keep the liberal out. So this is an interesting tactic. That what they're saying is, vote against the Liberals. Now, if you vote against the Liberals, you can vote Labour or you can vote Conservative. And the campaign doesn't say vote Labour. The campaign doesn't say vote Conservative. It just says don't vote Liberal, because they're the present government. This was very difficult in the campaign, because, of course, many people who agreed with the suffragettes said, yes, but the Liberals are very good on the question of Ireland, or on another question, or on welfare. So this is a slightly risky strategy, because, of course, if you're a movement, you want the maximum number of people with you. And if you have a campaign like this, then the Liberals who agree with you, that can be difficult. All difficult questions. The law to give the right to vote for women had some success before the First World War. So, for example, in 1909, the House of Commons voted yes to votes for women, but the government then stopped the bill and didn't take it to the House of Lords. Yeah. So they managed to get a majority vote in the House of Commons, but then the government said, we're not going to do it. Okay. Why was this? That's a difficult question. Why was this? Well, certainly one reason is that there were a small group of liberals at the top who were really very, very strongly against. Now, at that point, something completely new happened, and that is that the First World War arrived. One might imagine, well, what's going to happen now? And what we discovered was that the suffragettes and most of the suffragists, although they wanted radical change and the right to vote for women, they also defended the British Empire, and almost all the organisations said, stop the campaign for the right to vote for women. Everybody mobilised to support the war against Germany. So in general, the feminist leaders, just like the trade union leaders, supported the war, and they had an agreement with the government, we will support the war, and the government said, okay, we will release all the suffragette prisoners. The different organizations, suffragettes and maybe three different suffragist movements, had different ideas about the war, but almost all of them said supported the war in different ways. The suffragettes were the most enthusiastic about the war. For example, they campaigned for conscription. Peut-être vous vous rappelez que c'était des volontaires au début de la guerre dans l'armée en Angleterre, et seulement après 2 ans, il y avait la conscription. Eh bien, les suffragettes, ils ont fait campagne pour la conscription. Made it clear that there were some aspects of separate spheres which everybody agreed with. The suffragettes did not demand that women fight in the army, although in Russia women fought in the army. So there was this idea that of a partial questioning of separate spheres. Because it has to be said that although it's certainly true in general in the public sphere, life was much easier for men at this time, not always, and the big example is the war, of course. Let's say in 1906, in 1907, in 1908, in 1909, it's generally much better to be a man in Britain than a woman. In 1914, no, not really. Because you know they were obliged eventually to go to the war and be killed. There were other examples. So this is the separate spheres idea, which normally worked in favour of men, but not always. The other example is the Titanic. It's an example. Remember, the Titanic goes down, and most of the women survive, and most of the men are killed because the ideology is: if I'm a man, I have to die, and you can survive because I'm a man and you're a woman, and that's. That was the ideology. Okay, so there are times when. So here you have a poster. Women of Britain say go. Ce n'est pas un impératif, c'est un constat. Les femmes de l'Angleterre disent il faut y aller et rejoindre en tant que volontaire l'armée. And there they are. You see, there's the older woman, the younger woman, the child watching, worried, but saying that you must go. You will not be surprised to hear that popular songs were also involved here. And this was one of the most popular songs in 1914, at the end of 1914, was a woman singing this, "Oh, we don't want to lose you, but we think you ought to go to the army. For your king and your country both need you so. We shall want you and miss you, but with all our might and main we shall cheer you, hug you, kiss you when you come back again." And in the theatres they sung this, and then they had the sergeant come on the stairs and said, "You, man, will you join the army today? Are you proud to be an Englishman? Will you join the army?" And the women said, "Yes, join the army." Heavy situation. Will you join? No, okay. Okay, j'espère que vous allez le traiter comme il mérite celui-là. Okay, yeah, very, very, very strong, very, very strong pressure, sorry. Okay. Now, the war changed everything, and it also very much changed the life of women who stayed in Britain. One of the first things that happened is they very quickly realised that they needed a lot more women in the factories. The First World War was the first total war, and so it was the first war where every part of the economy was subordinated to the war effort. Because in fact, although war appears to be a military conflict, in fact it's an economic conflict. If your country can produce more tanks and guns and bullets and men and uniforms, then you win. This is why, in the end, the Americans made the difference, because it's the biggest economy. So there were more and more women in the factories. In particular, women who were domestic servants left domestic service happily and went into the factories because they preferred it very much so. They worked very long hours, of course, but there were women in the factories before the war, but there were far more during the war. Also, quite often they all lived together. So, for example, they suddenly built a big new factory, and a big camp for the unmarried women to live there, or some of the married women if their men were in the army. So it's a tremendous transformation. And there were other transformations as well. It was impossible during the war to have a normal football match, a men's football match. Because although in 1915, for example, there was no conscription, so the footballers could choose, "I want to join the army, I don't want to join the army." In reality, it was politically impossible to have a football match because the public would say, "Why aren't you in the army?" So the footballers are young and strong normally, yeah, compared with the rest of the population. And so they had to stop the football. But people in Britain love football. And one of the results was rather surprising, and that is that they organised a large number of women's football teams, and many, many people came to watch the women's football for the first time in a long time, anyway. So here you have a photograph of the women's football team. And this is a football team from a factory. And in fact, each factory had its football team. And that's a very interesting story. We're just beginning to find out the details of it, yeah? You need to remember that history only exists when somebody goes to find it. Yeah. And so a lot of the history of women's football we didn't know. And there's a new book about women's football, and it'll become very, very interesting. The transformation of women's lives in the war was very worrying. People were very worried. Because remember, most people considered that the difference between men and women was natural. So when they saw women's football, women bus drivers, they were very worried. And in my area, in popular songs, there are hundreds of popular songs about women's new roles. And this is I found this very interesting, because I imagined that you would have some songs saying, it's wonderful that women do these new things, and some songs saying, it's terrible. And that's not the case, in fact. In fact, most of the songs say, it's kind of good but worrying. And the last verse of most of the song says, after the war, the women will all be the same as before. After the war, the women will always be the same as before. Yeah, that this will not continue. A tremendous tension, you can read. And it's, you know, when the boys come home, the women will become naturally women again. So it's a temporary shift. And a lot of the changes were temporary. At the end of the war, most of the jobs for women disappeared, but not all of them. And in particular, in the office, the secretary, in 1900, secretaries were men. And in 1920, more and more, a lot of secretaries were women. And so it was like so there were some areas which remained open. At the end of the war, women over 30 were given the right to vote. A new law was passed in 1918, and this law gave the right to vote to more people. First of all, it gave the right to vote to all men, 100% of men, for the first time. Before the war, 75% of men had the vote. So the law in 1918 gave the vote to all men over 21 and all women over 30. Okay, so it's not equality. All men over 21, all women over 30. And the interesting question, but not an easy question, is why? In 1913, 1912, 1906, the government said no. And in 1918, the government says yes. Why? This is not an easy question. Some historians say it was to reward the women for all the work they did during the war. Personally, I don't believe this, because governments don't normally reward people for things. It's not an important logic. So what happened? It's certainly true that a section of the elite who really believed it is impossible for women to do this, when they saw what women did during the war, this is a small group, maybe 20 men, who really did change their mind, but they were very influential men. That's one element. I think the second element, though, is that they really did not want the suffragettes to begin their activity again. In 1918, 1919, there were many, many strikes. There were mutinies in the army. There was lots of radical movements, and the government really did not need another suffragette movement. It was so I think that's my personal opinion, but personal opinion as a historian, not just as a disc jockey. And so they did, in fact. Now, in a way, it was an accident, because the law. What was the problem? The problem is that there were elections coming up in 1918, and the present law, the existing law, would mean that the soldiers in France could not vote, because the law was you must be resident, etc. Now, it was politically impossible to not allow the soldiers to vote. And so they needed a new law, and then they added and women over 30. And here you have going to the polls in Plymouth in 1919, and you have a little sign here, vote for Lady Astor. And Lady Astor was the first woman member of Parliament. And there she is. There she is, the first woman member of Parliament in 1919. A Conservative, I think. Next slide, please. Oh, there she is. Okay, now, 10 years later, in 1929, all women got the votes. So, 10 years, faut attendre. So, why 10 years later? Well, it seems that the enfranchisement in 1918 of women over 30 demonstrated that it was not so dangerous. Nothing terrible happened. Yeah, in 1920, 1921, 1922, 1923, 1924, women could vote and nothing terrible happened, so that was reassuring. And so they finally wore this, and here you have, nevertheless, a lot of people continued to have the opinion that it was a bad thing. And so in 1929, when there was the Equal Franchise Act, there is this very hostile cartoon. And you can see it's the moment for women to decide who they want to vote for. It's another insult, I'm afraid. And you can see the problem in the opinion of Hazelden, who is against. This was in the Daily Mirror, a very important newspaper selling millions of copies at the time. Not so left-wing at the time. So first of all, yeah, will the responsibility of the vote weigh heavily on the woman? You know, will it be hard for the woman? So it's kind of mocking. Is she even now in the throes of studying political history? So that's supposed to be a joke, yeah? Because when you see a woman studying political history, you're supposed to say, oh, that's ridiculous. Yeah? Or arguing with another woman. This is also ridiculous. All these things are to be seen as ridiculous. Will she consult a man about it? Or will she toss up? Ou est-ce qu'elle va faire jouer au pile ou face? Because she's so stupid. And the last one, puisqu'on sait que les petites femmes n'ont rien dans la tête, ou est-ce qu'elle va oublier d'y aller? Oh, j'avais l'intention de voter, n'est-ce pas? Okay. So, again, an insulting poster about women from 1929. Now, the change that came with the right to vote for women is tremendously important. I think it's mostly that the official attitude when women did not have the vote was women are like children. That was the official attitude and the generally accepted attitude. And so once women did have the vote, that definitely changed. J'essaie de me réorganiser là un peu. Okay, so during the 1920s and the 1930s, the situation of women got a little bit better, and in general, living conditions were getting a little bit better. Housing, the number of children for each woman went down. And that's a very important difference, because it's very difficult to be a liberated woman when you have 12 children. And 12 was not unusual. 12 was not unusual in 1900. Yeah, the problem is not to tell women how many children to have, but it's true that if you are obliged to have 12 children, then liberation is kind of difficult to organize. Yeah. So that was one of the big changes. Women were involved in the general strike in 1926. And in general, this week I'm having a special talk about women, but we have to remember that when we talk about immigrants and Irish people and Jews and West Indians and workers, there are lots of women in all of these categories. Oh, sorry. No, I'm sorry. Go back. Yes, this is a photograph, in fact, from the Second World War. And in the Second World War, again, women went very much into male roles and took over in the factories and so on. The Second World War was rather different because the army was much smaller. Yeah. In the Second World War, the most important part of the experience was the bombing. So civilians in question. Okay. Et en fait, c'est, 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 euh, euh,